The future of babies now in utero is very uncertain. Their mothers are immune, granted, but statistical probability says that most of the fathers were not, and are now dead. What's the other possibility? That we may finish the job of destroying our species ourselves, Bateman said calmly. I actually think that's very possible. Not right away, because we're all too scattered. But man is a gregarious social animal, and eventually we'll get back together, if only so we can tell each other stories about how we survived the Great Plague of 1990. Most of the societies that form are apt to be primitive dictatorships run by little Caesars, unless we're very lucky. A few may be enlightened, democratic communities, and I'll tell you exactly what the necessary requirement for that kind of society in the 1990s and early 2000s is going to be. A community with enough technical people in it to get the lights back on. It could be done, and very easily. This isn't the aftermath of a nuclear war with everything laid to waste. All the machinery is just sitting there waiting for someone to come along, the right someone, who knows how to clean the plugs and replace a few burned-out bearings, and start it up again. It's all a question of how many of those who've been spared understand the technology we all took for granted. Stu sipped his beer. Think so? Sure. Bateman took a swallow of his own beer, then leaned forward and smiled grimly at Stu. Now let me give you a hypothetical situation, Mr. Stuart Redman from East Texas. Suppose we have Community A in Boston and Community B in Utica. They are aware of each other, and each community is aware of the conditions in the other community's camp. Society A is in good shape. They are living on Beacon Hill in the lap of luxury, because one of their members just happens to be a Con Ed repairman. This guy knows just enough to get the power plant which serves Beacon Hill running again. It would mostly be a matter of knowing which switches to pull when the plant went into an automatic shutdown. Once it's running, it's almost all automated anyhow. The repairman can teach other members of Society A which levers to pull and which gauges to watch. The turbines run on oil, of which there is a glut because everybody who used to use it is as dead as old Dad's hat band. So in Boston, the juice is flowing. There's heat against the cold, light so you can read at night, refrigeration so you can have your scotch on the rocks like a civilized man. In fact, life is pretty damn near idyllic. No pollution, no drug problem, no race problem, no shortages, no money or barter problem, because all the goods, if not the services, are out on display, and there are enough of them to last a radically reduced society for 3 centuries. Sociologically speaking, such a group would probably become communal in nature. No dictatorship here, the proper breeding ground for dictatorship, conditions of want, need, uncertainty, privation, they simply wouldn't exist. Boston would probably end up being run by a town meeting form of government again. But Community B, up there in Utica, there's no one to run the power plant. The technicians are all dead. It's going to take a long time for them to figure out how to make things go again. In the meantime, they're cold at night, and winter is coming. They're eating out of cans. They're miserable. A strong man takes over. They're glad to have him because they're confused and cold and sick. Let him make the decisions. And of course he does. He sends someone to Boston with a request. Will they send their pet technician up to Utica to help them get their power plant going again? The alternative is a long and dangerous move south for the winter. So what does Community A do when they get this message? They send the guy? Stu asked. Christ's testicles, no! He might be held against his will. In fact, it would be extremely likely. In the post-flu world, technological know-how is going to replace gold as the most perfect medium of exchange. And in those terms, Society A is rich and Society B is poor. So what does Society B do? I guess they go south, Stu said, then grinned. Maybe even to East Texas. Maybe, or maybe they threaten the Boston people with a nuclear warhead. Right, Stu said. They can't get their power plant gone, but they can fire a nuclear missile at Beantown. Bateman said, If it was me, I wouldn't bother with a missile. I'd just try to figure out how to detach the warhead, then drive it to Boston in a station wagon. Think that would work? Dogged if I know. Even if it didn't, there are plenty of conventional weapons around. That's the point. All of that stuff is lying around, waiting to be picked up. And if Communities A and B both have pet technicians, They might work up some kind of rusty nuclear exchange over religion, or territoriality, or some paltry ideological difference. Just think, instead of 6 or 7 world nuclear powers, we may end up with 60 or 70 of them right here in the continental United States. If the situation were different, I'm sure that there would be fighting with rocks and spiked clubs. But the fact is, all the old soldiers have faded away and left their playthings behind. It's a grim thing to be thinking about, especially after so many grim things have already happened. But I'm afraid it's entirely possible. A silence fell between them. Far off, they could hear Kojak barking in the woods as the day turned on its noontime axis. "You know," Bateman said finally, "I'm fundamentally a cheerful man, maybe because I have a low threshold of satisfaction. It's made me greatly disliked in my field. I have my faults, I talk too much, as you've heard, and I'm a terrible painter, as you've seen, and I used to be terribly unwise with money. I sometimes spent the last 3 days before payday eating peanut butter sandwiches, and I was notorious in Woodsville for opening savings accounts and then closing them out a week later. But I never really let it get me down, Stu. Eccentric but cheerful, that's me. The only bane of my life has been my dreams. Ever since boyhood, I've been plagued by amazingly vivid dreams. A lot of them have been nasty. As a youngster, it was trolls under bridges that reached up and grabbed my foot, or a witch that turned me into a bird. I would open my mouth to scream, and nothing but a string of caws would come out. Do you ever have bad dreams, Stu?" "Sometimes," Stu said, thinking of Elder, and how Elder lurched after him in his nightmares, and of the corridors that never ended but only switched back on themselves, lit by cold fluorescence and filled with echoes. "Then you know. When I was a teenager, I had the regular quota of sexy dreams, both wet and dry, but these were sometimes interspersed with dreams in which the girl I was with would change into a toad or a snake, or even a decaying corpse. As I grew older, I had dreams of failure, dreams of degradation, dreams of suicide, dreams of horrible accidental death. The most recurrent was one where I was slowly being crushed to death under a gas station lift. All simple permutations of the troll dream, I suppose. I really believe that such dreams are a simple psychological emetic, and the people who have them are more blessed than cursed."
"If you get rid of it, it doesn't pile up."
"Exactly. There are all sorts of dream interpretations, Freud's being the most notorious, but I've always believed they serve a simple eliminatory function, and not much more. The dreams are the psyche's way of taking a good dump every now and then, and that people who don't dream, or don't dream in a way they can often remember when they wake up, are mentally constipated in some way. After all, the only practical compensation for having a nightmare is waking up and realizing it was all just a dream." Stu smiled. "But lately, I've had an extremely bad dream. It recurs, like my dream of being crushed to death under the lift, but it makes that one look like a pussycat in comparison. It's like no other dream I've ever had, but somehow it's like all of them. As if it were the sum of all bad dreams. And I wake up feeling bad, as if it wasn't a dream at all, but a vision. I know how crazy that must sound."
"What is it?"
"It's a man," Bateman said quietly. "At least, I think it's a man. He's standing on the roof of a high building, or maybe it's a cliff that he's on. Whatever it is, it's so high that it shears away into mist thousands of feet below. It's near sunset, but he's looking the other way, east. Sometimes he seems to be wearing blue jeans and a denim jacket, but more often he's in a robe with a cowl. I can never see his face, but I can see his eyes. He has red eyes. And I have a feeling that he's looking for me, and that sooner or later he will find me, or I will be forced to go to him. And that will be the death of me. So I try to scream, and—" He trailed off with an embarrassed little shrug.
"That's when you wake up?"
"Yes." They watched Kojak come trotting back, and Bateman patted him while Kojak nosed in the aluminum dish and cleaned up the last of the pound cake. "Well, it's just a dream, I suppose," Bateman said. He stood up, wincing as his knees popped.
If I were being psychoanalyzed, I suppose the shrink would say the dream expresses my unconscious fear of some leader or leaders who will start the whole thing going again. Maybe a fear of technology in general. Because I do believe that all the new societies which arise, at least in the Western world, will have technology as their cornerstone. It's a pity, and it needn't be, but it will be, because we are hooked. They won't remember, or won't choose to remember, the corner we had painted ourselves into. The dirty rivers, the hole in the ozone layer, the atomic bomb, the atmospheric pollution. All they'll remember is that once upon a time they could keep warm at night without expending much effort to do it. I'm a Luddite on top of my other failings, you see. But this dream, it preys on me, Stu. Stu said nothing. "Well, I want to get back," Bateman said briskly. "I'm halfway drunk already, and I believe there will be thundershowers this afternoon." He walked to the back of the clearing and rummaged there. A few moments later, he came back with a wheelbarrow. He screwed the piano stool down to its lowest elevation, put it in, added his pallet, the picnic cooler, and balanced precariously on top of everything else his mediocre painting. "You wheeled that all the way out here?" Stu asked. "I wheeled it until I saw something I wanted to paint. I go different ways on different days. It's good exercise. If you're going east, why don't you come back to Woodsville and spend the night at my house? We can take turns wheeling the barrow, and I've got yet another six-pack of beer cooling in yonder stream. That ought to get us home in style." "I accept," Stu said. "Good man. I'll probably talk all the way home. You are in the arms of the garrulous professor, East Texas. When I bore you, just tell me to shut up. I won't be offended." "I like to listen," Stu said. "Then you are one of God's chosen. Let's go." So they walked on down 302, one of them wheeling the barrow while the other drank a beer. No matter which was which, Bateman talked, an endless monologue that jumped from topic to topic with hardly a pause. Kojak bounced alongside. Stu would listen for a while, then his thoughts would trail off for a while, following their own tangents, and then his mind would come back. He was disquieted by Bateman's picture of 100 little enclaves of people, some of them militaristic, living in a country where thousands of doomsday weapons had been left around like a child's set of blocks. But oddly, the thing his mind kept returning to was Glenn Bateman's dream, the man with no face on top of the high building or the cliff edge, the man with the red eyes, his back to the setting sun, looking restlessly to the east. He woke up sometime before midnight, bathed in sweat, afraid he had screamed. But in the next room, Glenn Bateman's breathing was slow and regular, undisturbed, and in the hallway he could see Kojak sleeping with his head on his paws. Everything was picked out in moonlight so bright it was surreal. When he woke, Stu had been up on his elbows, and now he lowered himself back to the damp sheet and put an arm over his eyes, not wanting to remember the dream but helpless to avoid it. He had been in Stovington again. Elder was dead. Everyone was dead. The place was an echoing tomb. He was the only one alive, and he couldn't find the way out. At first he tried to control his panic. "Walk, don't run," he told himself over and over. But soon he would have to run. His stride was becoming quicker and quicker, and the urge to look back over his shoulder and make sure that it was only the echoes behind him was becoming insuperable. He walked past closed office doors with names written in black on milky frosted glass. Past an overturned gurney, past the body of a nurse with her white skirt rucked up to her thighs, her blackened, grimacing face staring at the cold white inverted ice cube trays that were the ceiling fluorescents. At last he began to run. Faster, faster, the doors slipping by him and gone, his feet pounding on the linoleum. Orange arrows oozing on white cinder block. Signs. At first they seemed right. Radiology and Corridor B to labs and do not proceed beyond this point without valid pass. And then he was in another part of the installation, a part he had never seen and had never been meant to see. The paint on these walls had begun to peel and flake. Some of the fluorescents were out. Others buzzed like flies caught in a screen. Some of the frosted glass office windows were shattered, and through the stellated holes he had been able to see wreckage and bodies in terrible positions of pain. There was blood. These people had not died of the flu. These people had been murdered. Their bodies had sustained punctures and gunshot wounds, and the grisly traumas which could only have been inflicted by blunt instruments. Their eyes bulged and stared. He plunged down a stopped escalator and into a long dark tunnel lined with tile. At the other end there were more offices, but now the doors were painted dead black. The arrows were bright red. The fluorescence buzzed and flickered. The signs read, "This way to cobalt urns, and laser armory, and sidewinder missiles, and plague room." Then, sobbing with relief, he saw an arrow pointing around a right-angled turn and the single blessed word above it, "Exit." He went around the corner and the door was standing open. Beyond it was the sweet, fragrant night. He plunged toward the door and then, stepping into it, blocking his way, was a man in jeans and a denim jacket. Stu skidded to a stop, a scream locked in his throat like rusty iron. As the man stepped into the glow of the flickering fluorescence, Stu saw that there was only a cold black shadow where his face should have been, a blackness punched by two soulless red eyes. No soul, but a sense of humor. There was that, a kind of dancing, lunatic glee. The dark man put out his hands, and Stu saw that they were dripping blood. "Heaven and earth," the dark man whispered from that empty hole where his face should have been. "All of heaven and earth." Stu had awakened. Now Kojak moaned and growled softly in the hall. His paws twitched in his sleep, and Stu supposed that even dogs dreamed. It was a perfectly natural thing, dreaming, even an occasional nightmare. But it was a long time before he could get back to sleep. Chapter 38. As the superflu epidemic wound down, there was a second epidemic that lasted roughly 2 weeks. This epidemic was most common in technological societies, such as the United States, least common in underdeveloped countries, such as Peru or Senegal. In the United States, the second epidemic took about 16% of the superflu survivors. In places like Peru and Senegal, no more than 3%. The second epidemic had no name because the symptoms differed wildly from case to case. A sociologist like Glenn Bateman might have called this second epidemic natural death or those old emergency room blues. In a strictly Darwinian sense, it was the final cut, the unkindest cut of all, some might have said. Sam Tauber was 5.5 years old. His mother had died on June the 24th in the Murfreesboro, Georgia General Hospital. On the 25th, his father and younger sister, 2-year-old April, had died. On June the 27th, his older brother Mike died, leaving Sam to shift for himself. Sam had been in shock ever since the death of his mother. He wandered carelessly up and down the streets of Murfreesboro, eating when he was hungry, sometimes crying. After a while, he stopped crying, because crying did no good. It didn't bring the people back. At night, his sleep was broken by horrible nightmares in which Papa and April and Mike died over and over, their faces swollen black, a terrible rattling sound in their chests as they strangled on their own snot. At 10:15 on the morning of July 2nd, Sam wandered into a field of wild blackberries behind Hattie Reynolds's house. Bemused and vacant-eyed, he zigzagged among blackberry bushes that were almost twice as tall as he was, picking the berries and eating them until his lips and chin were smeared black. The thorns ripped at his clothes and sometimes at his bare flesh, but he barely noticed. Bees hummed drowsily around him. He never saw the old and rotted well cover half buried in tall grass and blackberry creepers. It gave under his wake with a grinding, splintering crash, and Sam plunged 20 feet down the rock-lined shaft to the dry bottom, where he broke both legs. He died 20 hours later, as much from fear and misery as from shock and hunger and dehydration. Irma Fayette lived in Lodi, California. She was a lady of 26, a virgin, morbidly afraid of rape. Her life had been one long nightmare since June 23rd, when looting had broken out in town and there had been no police to stop the looters. Irma had a small house on a side street. Her mother had lived there with her until she had died of a stroke in 1985. When the looting began and the gunshots and the horrifying sound of drunken men roaring up and down the streets of the main business section on motorcycles, Irma had locked all the doors and then had hidden in the spare room downstairs. Since then she had crept upstairs periodically, quiet as a mouse, to get food or to relieve herself. Irma didn't like people. If everyone on Earth had died but her, she would have been perfectly happy. But that wasn't the case. Only yesterday, after she had begun cautiously to hope that no one was left in Lodi but her, she had seen a gross and drunken man, a hippie man in a T-shirt that said, "I gave up sex and drinking and it was the scariest 20 minutes of my life," wandering up the street with a bottle of whiskey in his hand. He had long blonde hair which cascaded out from under the gimme cap he was wearing and all the way down to his shoulders. Tucked into the waistband of his tight blue jeans was a pistol. Irma had peeked around the bedroom curtain at him until he was out of sight, and then had scurried downstairs to the barricaded spare room as if she had been released from a malign spell. They were not all dead. If there was one hippie man left, there would be other hippie men. And they would all be rapers. They would rape her. Sooner or later they would find her and rape her. This morning, before first light, she had crept up to the attic where her father's few possessions were stored in cardboard boxes. Her father had been a merchant seaman. He had deserted Irma's mother in the late 60s. Irma's mother had told Irma all about it. She had been perfectly frank. Her father had been a beast who got drunk and then wanted to rape her. They all did. When you got married, that gave a man the right to rape you any time he wanted. Even in the daytime. Irma's mother always summed up her husband's desertion in three words, the same words Irma could have applied to the death of almost every man, woman, and child on the face of the earth. No great loss. Most of the boxes contained nothing but cheap trinkets bought in foreign ports. Souvenir of Hong Kong, souvenir of Saigon, souvenir of Copenhagen. There was a scrapbook of photographs. Most of them showed her father on ship, sometimes smiling into the camera with his arms about the shoulders of his fellow beasts. Well, probably the disease that they were calling Captain Trips out here had struck him down in whatever place he had run off to. No great loss. But there was one wooden box with small gold hinges on it, and in this box was a gun, a 45 caliber pistol. It lay on red velvet, and in a secret compartment below the red velvet were some bullets. They were green and mossy-looking, but Irma thought they would work all right. Bullets were metal. They didn't spoil like milk or cheese. She loaded the gun under the single cobwebby attic bulb, and then went down to eat her breakfast at her own kitchen table. She would not hide like a mouse in a hole any longer. She was armed. Let the rapers beware. That afternoon she went out on the front porch to read her book. The name of the book was Satan is Alive and Well on the Planet Earth. It was grim and joyful stuff. The sinners and the ingrates had gotten their just deserts, just as the book said they would. They were all gone, except for a few hippie rapers, and she guessed she could handle them. The gun was by her side. At 2 o'clock, the man with the blonde hair came back. He was so drunk he could hardly stand up. He saw Irma and his face lighted, no doubt thinking of how lucky he had been to finally discover some pussy. "Hey, baby," he cried. "It's just you and me. How long—" Then terror clouded his face as he saw Irma put down her book and raise the 45. "Hey, listen, put that thing down. Is it loaded? Hey!" Irma pulled the trigger. The pistol exploded, killing her instantly. No great loss. George McDougal lived in Nyack, New York. He had been a teacher of high school mathematics, specializing in remedial work. He and his wife had been practicing Catholics, and Harriet McDougal had borne him 11 children, 9 boys and 2 girls. So between June 22nd, when his 9-year-old son Jeff had succumbed to what was then diagnosed as flu-related pneumonia, and on June 29th, when his 16-year-old daughter Patricia, oh God, she had been so young and so achingly beautiful, had succumbed to what everyone, those that were left, was then calling tube neck, He had seen the 12 people he loved best in the world pass away, while he himself remained healthy and feeling fine. He had joked at school about not being able to remember all his kids' names, but the order of their passing was engraved in his memory. Jeff on the 22nd, Marty and Helen on the 23rd, his wife Harriet and Bill and George Jr. and Robert and Stan on the 24th, Richard on the 25th, Danny on the 27th, 3-year-old Frank on the 28th, and finally Pat. And Pat had seemed to be getting better right up to the end. George thought he would go mad. He had begun jogging 10 years before on his doctor's advice. He didn't play tennis or handball, paid a kid, one of his, of course, to mow the lawn, and usually drove to the corner store when Harriet needed a loaf of bread. "You're putting on weight," Dr. Warner had said. "Lead in the seat. No good for your heart. Try jogging." So he had gotten a sweatsuit and had gone jogging every night, for short distances at the start, then longer and longer ones. At first he'd felt self-conscious, sure that the neighbors must be tapping their foreheads and rolling their eyes, and then a couple of the men that he had only known to wave to when they were out watering their lawns came and asked if they could join him. Probably there was safety in numbers. By that time, George's 2 oldest boys had also joined in. It became a sort of neighborhood thing, and although the membership was always evolving as people dropped in and dropped out, it stayed a neighborhood thing. Now that everyone was gone, he still jogged. Every day. For hours. It was only when he was jogging, concentrating on nothing more than the thud of his tennis shoes on the sidewalk and the swing of his arms and his steady, harsh respiration, that he lost that feeling of impending madness. He could not commit suicide because, as a practicing Catholic, he knew that suicide was a mortal sin, and God must be saving him for something, so he jogged. Yesterday he had jogged for almost 6 hours, until he was completely out of breath and almost retching with exhaustion. He was 51, not a young man anymore, and he supposed that so much running was not good for him, but in another more important way, it was the only thing that was any good. So he had gotten up this morning at first light after a mostly sleepless night. The thought that played over and over in his mind was, Jeff, Marty, Helen, Harriet, Bill, George Jr., Robert, Stanley, Richard, Danny, Frank, Patty, and I thought she was getting better. And put on his sweatsuit. He went out and began to jog up and down the deserted streets of Nyack, his feet sometimes gritting on broken glass, once leaping over a TV set that lay shattered on the pavement, taking him past residential streets where the shades were drawn, and also past the horrible 3-car crash at the Main Street intersection. He jogged at first, but it became necessary to run faster and faster to keep the thoughts behind him. He jogged, and then he trotted, and then he ran, and finally he sprinted, a 51-year-old man with gray hair and a gray sweatsuit and white tennis shoes, fleeing up and down empty streets as if all the devils of hell were after him. At 11:15 he suffered a massive coronary thrombosis and fell down dead on the corner of Oak and Pine near a fire plug. The expression on his face was very like gratitude. Mrs. Eileen Drummond of Clewiston, Florida, got very drunk on DeKuyper creme de menthe on the afternoon of July 2nd. She wanted to get drunk because if she was drunk she wouldn't have to think about her family, and creme de menthe was the only kind of alcohol she could stand. She had found a baggie filled with marijuana in her 16-year-old's room the day before, and had succeeded in getting stoned, but being stoned only seemed to make things worse. She had sat in her living room all afternoon, stoned and crying over photographs in her scrapbook. So this afternoon she drank a whole bottle of creme de menthe and then got sick and threw up in the bathroom and then went to bed and lit a cigarette and fell asleep and burned the house down, and she didn't have to think about it anymore, ever. The wind had freshened, and she also burned down most of Clewiston. No great loss. Arthur Stimson lived in Reno, Nevada. On the afternoon of the 29th, after swimming in Lake Tahoe, he stepped on a rusty nail. The wound turned gangrenous. He diagnosed the trouble by smell and tried to amputate his foot. Halfway through the operation, he fainted and died of shock and blood loss in the lobby of Toby Harris Gambling Casino, where he had attempted the operation. In Swanville, Maine, a 10-year-old girl named Candace Moran fell off her bike and died of a fractured skull. Milton Kraslow, a rancher in Harding County, New Mexico, was bitten by a rattlesnake and died half an hour later. In Milltown, Kentucky, Judy Horton was quite pleased with events. Judy was 17 years old and pretty. 2 years before, she had made two serious mistakes. She had allowed herself to get pregnant, and she had allowed her parents to talk her into marrying the boy responsible, a Four Eyes engineering student from the state university. At 15, she had been flattered just to be asked out by a college man, even if he was only a freshman, and for the life of her, she couldn't remember why she had allowed Waldo Horton, what a yuck name, to work his will on her. And if she was going to be knocked up, why did it have to be him? Judy had also allowed Steve Phillips and Mark Collins to work their will on her. They were both on the Milltown High football team, the Milltown Cougars, to be exact. Fight, 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 fight for the dear blue and white. And she was a cheerleader. If it hadn't been for yucky old Waldo Horton, she would have made head cheerleader her junior year easy. And getting back to the point, either Steve or Mark would have made more acceptable husbands. They both had broad shoulders, and Mark had stone bitch and shoulder-length blonde hair. But it was Waldo. It could have been no one but Waldo. All she had to do was look in her diary and do the arithmetic. And after the baby came, she wouldn't have even had to do that. It looked just like him. Yucky. So for 2 long years, she had struggled along through a variety of crummy jobs in fast food restaurants and motels while Waldo went to school. It got so she hated Waldo's school most of all, even more than the baby and Waldo himself. If he wanted a family so bad, why couldn't he get out and work? She had, but her parents and his wouldn't allow it. Alone, Judy could have sweet-talked him into it. She would have gotten him to promise before she let him touch her in bed. But all four of the in-laws had their noses in things all the time. Oh, Judy, things will be so much better when Waldo has a good job. Oh, Judy, things would look so much brighter if you'd go to church more often. Oh, Judy, eat shit and keep smiling until you get it down, until you get it all down. Then the superfluid come along and had solved all her problems. Her parents had died. Her little boy Petey had died. That was sort of sad, but she got over it in a couple of days. Then Waldo's parents had died, and finally Waldo himself had died, and she was free. The thought that she herself might die had never crossed her mind, and of course she didn't. They had been living in a large and rambling apartment house in downtown Milltown, one of the features of the place that sold Waldo on it, Judy of course didn't have a say, was a large walk-in meat freezer in the basement. They had taken the apartment in September of 1988, and their apartment was on the third floor, and who always seemed to get stuck taking the roast and the hamburger down to the freezer? Three guesses, and the first two don't count. Waldo and Petey had died at home. By that time, you couldn't get hospital service unless you were a bigwig and the mortuaries were swamped. Creepy old places anyway, Judy wouldn't go near one on a bet. But the power was still on, so she had taken them downstairs and put them in the freezer. The power had gone off in Milltown 3 days ago, but it was still fairly cool down there. Judy knew because she went down to look at their dead bodies 3 or 4 times a day. She told herself she was just checking. What else could it be? Surely she wasn't gloating. She went down on the afternoon of July 2nd and forgot to put the rubber wedge under the freezer door. The door swung shut behind her and latched. It was then that she noticed, after 2 years of coming and going down here, that there was no inside knob on the freezer door. By then it was too warm to freeze, but not too cold to starve. So Judy Horton died in the company of her son and husband after all. Jim Lee of Hattiesburg, Mississippi, hooked up all the electrical outlets in his house to a gasoline generator and then electrocuted himself trying to start it up. Richard Hoggins was a young black man who had lived his entire life in Detroit, Michigan. He had been addicted to the fine white powder he called heroin for the last 5 years. During the actual superflu epidemic, he had gone through extreme withdrawal, as all the pushers and users he knew died or fled. On this bright summer afternoon, he was sitting on a littered stoop, drinking a warm 7-Up and wishing he had a pop, just a small minor skin pop. He began to think about Allie McFarlane, and something he had heard about Allie on the streets just before the shit hit the fan. People were saying that Allie, who was about the third biggest in Detroit, had just gotten a fine shipment. Everybody was going to get well. None of that brown shit. China White, all kinds of the stuff. Richie didn't know for sure where McFarlane would keep a big order like that. It wasn't healthy to know about such things. But he had heard it said at different times in passing that if the cops ever got a search writ for the Grosse Pointe house that Allie had bought for his great-uncle, Allie would go away until the new moon turned to gold. Richie decided to take a walk up to Grosse Pointe. After all, there was nothing better to do. He got the Lakeshore Drive address of one Aaron D. McFarlane from the Detroit phone book and walked out there. It was almost dark by the time he made it, and his feet hurt. He was no longer trying to tell himself that this was just a casual stroll. He wanted to shoot, and he wanted to bad. There was a gray fieldstone wall around the estate, and Richie went over it like a black shadow, cutting his hands on the broken glass embedded on the top. When he broke a window to gain entry, a burglar alarm went off, causing him to flee halfway down the lawn before he remembered there were no cops to answer. He came back, jittery and slicked with sweat. The main power was off, and there were easily 20 rooms in the fucking place. He'd have to wait until tomorrow to look properly, and it would still take 3 weeks to dump the place upside down in the proper way. And the stuff probably wasn't even here. Christ, Richie felt sick despair wave through him. But he would at least look in the obvious places. And in the upstairs bathroom, he found a dozen large plastic bags bulging with white powder. They were in the toilet tank, that old standby. Richie stared at them, sick with desire, dimly thinking that Allie must have been greasing all the right people if he could afford to leave a stash like this in a fucking toilet tank. There was enough dope here to last one man 16 centuries. He took one bag into the master bedroom and broke it open on the bedspread. His hands trembled as he got his works out and cooked up. It never occurred to him to wonder how much this stuff was cut. On the street, the heaviest hit Richie had ever taken was 12% pure, and that had put him into a sleep so deep it was nearly a coma. He hadn't even nodded. Just bang, and off he went, out of the blue and into the black. He injected himself above the elbow and pushed the plunger of his spike home. The stuff was almost 96% pure. It hit his bloodstream like a highballing freight, and Richie fell down on the bags of heroin, flowering the front of his shirt with it. He was dead 6 minutes later. No great loss. Chapter 39. Lloyd Henreid was down on his knees. He was humming and grinning. Every now and then he would forget what he had been humming, and the grin would fade, and he would sob a little bit, and then he would forget he was crying and go on humming. The song he was humming was Camptown Races. Every now and then, instead of humming or sobbing, he would whisper, "Doo-dah, doo-dah," under his breath. The holding cell block was utterly quiet except for the humming, the sobbing, the occasional doo-dah, and the soft scrape of the cot leg as Lloyd fumbled with it. He was trying to turn Trask's body around so he could get at the leg. "Please, waiter, bring me some more of that coleslaw and another leg." Lloyd looked like a man who had embarked upon a radical crash diet. His prison coverall hung on his body like a limp sail. The last meal served in the holding cell block had been lunch 8 days ago. Lloyd's skin was stretched tightly across his face, limning every curve and angle of the skull beneath. His eyes were bright and glittering. His lips had drawn back from his teeth. He had an oddly piebald look because his hair had begun to fall out in clumps. He looked crazy.
"Doo-dah, doo-dah," Lloyd whispered as he fished with his cot leg.
Once upon a time he hadn't known why he had bothered hurting his fingers to unscrew the damn thing. Once upon a time, he had thought he had known what real hunger was. That hunger had been nothing but a slight edge to the appetite when compared with this.
"Ride around all night, ride around all day, doo-dah."
The cot leg snagged at the calf of Trask's pants leg, and then pulled free. Lloyd put his head down and sobbed like a child. Behind him, tossed indifferently in one corner, was the skeleton of the rat he had killed in Trask's cell on June 29th, 5 days ago. The rat's long pink tail was still attached to the skeleton.
Lloyd had tried repeatedly to eat the tail, but it was too tough. Almost all the water in the toilet bowl was gone, despite his efforts to conserve it. The cell was filled with the reek of urine. He had been peeing out into the corridor so as not to contaminate his water supply. He had not, and this was understandable enough considering the radically reduced conditions of his diet, had to move his bowels. He had eaten the food he had squirreled away too fast. He knew that now. He had thought someone would come. He hadn't been able to believe. He didn't want to eat Trask. The thought of eating Trask was horrible. Just last night he had managed to slap one of his slippers over a cockroach and had eaten it alive. He had felt it scuttering madly around inside his mouth just before his teeth had crunched it in two. Actually, it hadn't been half bad, much tastier than the rat. No, he didn't want to eat Trask. He didn't want to be a cannibal. It was like the rat. He would get Trask over within reaching distance, but just in case. Just in case. He had heard a man could go a long time without food as long as he had water. Not much water, but I won't think about that now, not just now, no, not just now. He didn't want to die. He didn't want to starve. He was too full of hate. The hate had built up at a fairly leisurely pace over the last 3 days, growing with his hunger. He supposed that if his long-dead pet rabbit had been capable of thought, it would have hated him in the same way. He slept a great deal now, and his sleep was always troubled with dreams of his rabbit, its body swollen, its fur matted, the maggots squirming in its eyes, and worst of all, those bloody paws. When he awoke, he would look at his own fingers in dread fascination. Lloyd's hate had coalesced around a simple, imagistic concept, and this concept was the key. He was locked in. Once upon a time, it had seemed right that he should be. He was one of the bad guys. Not a really bad guy. Poke had been the really bad guy. Small shit was the worst he would have done without Poke. Still, he shared a certain amount of the blame. There had been Gorgeous George in Vegas, and the three people in the White Continental. He had been in on that, and he supposed he had owned some of that heat. He supposed he deserved to take a fall, do a little time. It wasn't something you volunteered for, but when they had you cold, they gave you the bullet and you ate it. Like he had told the lawyer, he thought he deserved about 20 for his part in the tri-state kill spree. Not in the electric chair, Christ, no. The thought of Lloyd Henry riding the lightning was just, it was crazy. But they had the key. That was the thing. They could lock you up and do what they wanted with you. In the last 3 days, Lloyd had vaguely begun to grasp the symbolic talismanic power of the key. The key was your reward for playing by the rules. If you didn't, they could lock you up. It was no different than the go-to-jail card in Monopoly. Do not pass go, do not collect $200. And the key went with certain prerogatives. They could take away 10 years of your life, or 20, or 40. They could hire people like Mathers to beat on you. They could even take away your life in the electric chair. But having the key didn't give them the right to go away and leave you locked up to starve. It didn't give them the right to force you into eating a dead rat and then to try to eat the dry ticking of your mattress. It didn't give them the right to leave you in a spot where you might just have to eat the man in the next cell to stay alive. If you can get a hold of him, that is. Do-da, do-da. There were certain things you just couldn't do to people. Having the key only took you so far and no farther. They had left him here to die a horrible death when they could have let him out. He wasn't a mad dog killer who was going to waste the first person he saw, in spite of what the papers had said. Small shit was the worst he had ever gotten into before meeting Poke. So he hated, and the hate commanded him to live, or at least to try. For a while it seemed to him that the hate and the determination to go on living were useless things, because all of those who had the key had succumbed to the flu. They were beyond the reach of his vengeance. Then, little by little, as he grew hungrier, he realized that the flu wouldn't kill them. It would kill the losers like him. It would kill Mathers, but not that scumbag screw who had hired Mathers, because the screw had the key. It wasn't going to kill the governor or the warden. The guard who said the warden was sick had obviously been a fucking liar. It wasn't going to kill the parole officers, the county sheriffs, or the FBI agents. The flu would not touch those who had the key. It wouldn't dare. But Lloyd would touch them. If he lived long enough to get out of here, he would touch them plenty. The cot leg snagged in Trask's cuff again.
"Come on," Lloyd whispered. "Come on. Come on over here. Camptown ladies sing this song. All de do da day."
Trask's body slid slowly, stiffly, along the floor of his cell. No fisherman ever played a bonita more carefully or with greater wile than Lloyd played Trask. Once Trask's trousers ripped, and Lloyd had to hook on in a new place. But at last his foot was close enough so that Lloyd could reach through the bars and grab it, if he wanted to.
"Nothing personal," he whispered to Trask.
He touched Trask's leg. He caressed it.
"Nothing personal. I ain't gonna eat you, old buddy. Not less I have to."
He was not even aware that he was salivating. Lloyd heard someone in the ashy afterglow of dusk, and at first the sound was so far away and so strange, the clash of metal on metal, that he thought he must be dreaming it. The waking and sleeping states had become very similar to him now. He crossed back and forth across that boundary almost without knowing it. But then the voice came, and he snapped upright on his cot, his eyes flaring wide, huge and lambent in his starved face. The voice came floating down the corridors from God knew how far up in the administration wing, and then down the stairwell to the hallways which connected the visiting areas to the central cell block, where Lloyd was. It bobbed serenely through the twice-barred doors and finally reached Lloyd's ears.
"Hoo-hoo! Anybody home?"
And strangely, Lloyd's first thought was, "Don't answer. Maybe he'll go away."
"Anybody home? Going once? Going twice? Okay, I'm on my way, just about to shake the dust of Phoenix from my boots."
At that, Lloyd's paralysis broke. He catapulted off the cot, snatched up the cot leg, and began to beat it frantically on the bars. The vibrations raced up the metal and shivered in the bones of his clenched fist.
"No!" he screamed. "No, don't go! Please don't go!"
The voice, closer now, coming from the stairway between the administration and this floor.
"We'll eat you up, we love you so. And oh, someone sounds so hungry."
This was followed by a lazy chuckle. Lloyd dropped the cot leg on the floor and wrapped both hands around the bars of the cell door. Now he could hear the footfalls, somewhere up in the shadows, clocking steadily down the hall that led to the holding cell block. Lloyd wanted to burst into tears of relief. After all, he was saved. Yet it was not joy, but fear he felt in his heart, a growing dread that made him wish he had stayed silent. Stayed silent? My God, what could be worse than starvation? Starvation made him think of Trask. Trask lay sprawled on his back in the ashy afterglow of dusk, one leg stretched stiffly into Lloyd's cell, and an essential subtraction had occurred in the region of that leg's calf, the fleshy part of that leg's calf. There were teeth marks there. Lloyd knew whose teeth had made those marks, but he had only the vaguest memory of lunching on filet of Trask. All the same, powerful feelings of revulsion, guilt, and horror filled him. He rushed across to the bars and pushed Trask's leg back into his own cell. Then, looking over his right shoulder to make sure the owner of the voice was not yet in sight, he reached through, and with the dividing bars pressed against his face, he pulled Trask's pants leg down, hiding what he had done. Of course, there was no great hurry, because the barred gates at the head of the cell block were shut, and with the power off, the push button wouldn't work. His rescuer would have to go back and find the key. He would have to... Lloyd grunted as the electric motor which operated the barred gates whined into life. The silence of the cell block magnified the sound, which ceased with the familiar click-slam of the gates locking open. Then the steps were clocking steadily up the cell block walkway. Lloyd had gone to his cell door again after neatening up Trask. Now he involuntarily fell back two steps.
He dropped his gaze to the floor outside, and what he saw first was a pair of dusty cowboy boots with pointed toes and run-down heels, and his first thought was that Poke had a pair like that. The boots stopped in front of his cell. His gaze rose slowly, taking in the faded jeans snugged down over the boots, the leather belt with the brass buckle, various astrological signs inside a pair of concentric circles, the jeans jacket with a button pinned to each of the breast pockets, a smiley smile face on one, a dead pig and the words, "How's your pork?" on the other. At the same instant, Lloyd's eyes reluctantly reached Randall Flagg's darkly flushed face. Flagg screamed, "Boo!" The single sound floated down the dead cell block and then rushed back. Lloyd shrieked, stumbled over his own feet, fell down, and began to cry.
"That's all right," Flagg soothed.
"Hey, man, that's all right. Everything's purely all right."
Lloyd sobbed,
"Can you let me out? Please let me out. I don't want to be like my rabbit. I don't want to end up like that. It's not fair. If it wasn't for Poke, I never would have got into anything but small shit. Please let me out, mister. I'll do anything."
"You poor guy. You look like an advertisement for a summer vacation at Dachau."
Despite the sympathy in Flagg's voice, Lloyd could not bring himself to raise his eyes beyond the knees of the newcomer's jeans. If he looked into that face again, it would kill him. It was the face of a devil.
"Please," Lloyd mumbled. "Please let me out. I'm starving."
"How long have you been shit-canned, my friend?"
"I don't know," Lloyd said, wiping his eyes with thin fingers. "A long time."
"How come you're not dead already?"
"I knew what was coming,"
Lloyd told the blue-jeaned legs as he drew the last tattered shreds of his cunning around him.
"I saved up my food, that's what."
"Didn't happen to have a chomp on this fine fellow in the next cell by any chance?"
"What?"
Lloyd croaked.
"What? No, Christ's sake, what do you think I am? Mister, please."
"His left leg there looks a little thinner than his right one. That's the only reason I asked, my good friend."
"I don't know nothing about that,"
Lloyd whispered. He was trembling all over.
"How about Br'er Rat? How did he taste?"
Lloyd put his hands over his face and said nothing.
"What's your name?"
Lloyd tried to say, but all that came out was a moan.
"What's your name, soldier?"
"Lloyd Henry."
He tried to think what to say next, but his mind was a chaotic jumble. He had been afraid when his lawyer told him he might go to the electric chair, but not this afraid. He had never been this afraid in his entire life.
"It was all Poke's idea," he screamed. "Poke should be here, not me."
"Look at me, Lloyd."
"No,"
Lloyd whispered. His eyes rolled wildly.
"Why not?"
"Because..."
"Go on."
"Because I don't think you're real,"
Lloyd whispered.
"And if you are real, mister, if you're real, you're the devil."
"Look at me, Lloyd."
Helplessly, Lloyd turned his eyes up to that dark, grinning face that hung behind an intersection of bars. The right hand held something up beside the right eye. Looking at it made Lloyd feel cold and hot all over. It looked like a black stone, so dark it seemed almost resinous and pitchy. There was a red flaw in the center of it, and to Lloyd it looked like a terrible eye, bloody and half-open, peering at him. Then Flagg turned it slightly between his fingers, and the red flaw in the dark stone looked like a key. Flagg turned it back and forth between his fingers. Now it was the eye, now it was the key. The eye, the key. He sang, "She brought me coffee, she brought me tea, she brought me damn near everything but the workhouse key." "Right, Lloyd?"
"Sure,"
Lloyd said huskily. His eyes never left the small dark stone. Flagg began to walk it from one finger to the next like a magician doing a trick.
"Now, you're a man who must appreciate the value of a good key," the man said.
The dark stone disappeared in his clenched fist and suddenly reappeared in his other hand, where it began to finger walk again.
"I'm sure you are,"
Because what a key is for is opening doors. Is there anything more important in life than opening doors, Lloyd?
Mister, I'm awful hungry.
Sure you are, the man said. An expression of concern spread over his face, an expression so magnified that it became grotesque. Jesus Christ, a rat isn't anything to eat.
Why, do you know what I had for lunch?
I had a nice rare roast beef sandwich on Vienna bread with a few onions and a lot of golden spicy brown. Sound good?
Lloyd nodded his head, tears oozing slowly out of his overbright eyes.
Had some home fries and chocolate milk to go with it, and then for dessert...
Oh, holy crow, I'm torturing you, ain't I? Someone ought to take a horsewhip to me, that's what they ought to do.
I'm sorry.
I'll let you ride out and then we'll go get something to eat, okay?
Lloyd was too stunned to even nod. He had decided that the man with the key was indeed a devil, or even more likely a mirage, and the mirage would stand outside his cell until Lloyd finally dropped dead, talking happily about God and Jesus and Golden's spicy brown mustard as he made the strange black stone appear and disappear. But now the compassion on the man's face seemed real enough, and he sounded genuinely disgusted with himself. The black stone disappeared into his clenched fist again, and when the fist opened, Lloyd's wondering eyes beheld a flat silver key with an ornate grip lying on the stranger's palm.
"My dear God!" Lloyd croaked.
"You like that?" the man asked, pleased.
"I learned that trick from a massage parlor, honey, in Secaucus, New Jersey, Lloyd. Secaucus, home of the world's greatest pig farms."
He bent and seated the key in the lock of Lloyd's cell, and that was strange, because as well as his memory served him, which right now was not very well, these cells had no keyways, because they were all opened and shut electronically. But he had no doubt that the silver key would work. Just as it rattled home, Flagg stopped and looked at Lloyd, grinning slyly, and Lloyd felt despair wash over him again. It was all just a trick.
"Did I introduce myself? The name is Flagg, with the double G. Pleased to meet you."
"Likewise," Lloyd croaked.
"And I think, before I open this cell and we go get some dinner, we ought to have a little understanding, Lloyd."
"Sure thing," Lloyd croaked, and began to cry again.
"I'm going to make you my right-hand man, Lloyd. Going to put you right up there with St. Peter. When I open this door, I'm going to slip the keys to the kingdom right into your hand. What a deal, right?"
"Yeah,"
Lloyd whispered, growing frightened again. It was almost full dark now. Flagg was little more than a dark shape, but his eyes were still perfectly visible. They seemed to glow in the dark like the eyes of a lynx, one to the left of the bar that ended in the lockbox, one to the right. Lloyd felt terror, but something else as well. A kind of religious ecstasy, a pleasure, the pleasure of being chosen, the feeling that he had somehow won through to something.
"You'd like to get even with the people who left you here, isn't that right?"
"Boy, that sure is,"
Lloyd said, forgetting his terror momentarily. It was swallowed up by a starving, sinewy anger.
"Not just those people, but everyone who would do a thing like that,"
Flagg suggested.
"It's a type of person, isn't it? To a certain type of person, a man like you is nothing but garbage. Because they are high up. They don't think a person like you has a right to live."
"That's just right," Lloyd said.
His great hunger had suddenly been changed into a different kind of hunger. It had changed just as surely as the black stone had changed into the silver key. This man had expressed all the complex things he had felt in just a handful of sentences. It wasn't just the gate guard he wanted to get even with. Why, here's the wise-ass puss bag. What's the story, puss bag? Got anything smart to say? Because the gate guard wasn't the one. The gate guard had had the key, all right, but the gate guard had not made the key. Someone had given it to him. The warden, Lloyd supposed, but the warden hadn't made the key either. Lloyd wanted to find the makers and forgers. They would be immune to the flu, and he had business with them. Oh, yes, and it was good business. You know what the Bible says about people like that? Flagg asked quietly. It says the exalted shall be abased, and the mighty shall be brought low, and the stiff-necked shall be broken. And do you know what it says about people like you, Lloyd? It says, blessed are the meek, for they